foraging can be a great way to get outdoors and put some food on the table. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on WPR. And we're going to be talking about foraging for your own wild herbs, your own mushrooms, and make some tea. Kevin Olson, our guest. He is a forager and founder of Northwoods Tea and Herb. His company is based in Wausau and, of course, has done a lot of foraging. And maybe you are a forager. Have you tried it? How do you ID the plants that you eat? Questions you have about safety and safely foraging for the first time, you can join in. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Kevin Olson, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining in. We're having some problems reaching Kevin. I think we're having some technical problems. You know, that happens sometimes when we have guests on by phone or via some other method. Not the guest's fault. Typically, it's something in the air or something with our equipment. We'll get to him. We're trying to reach him right now, and we will get to him. I want to go back just to molds, mushrooms, and medicines for a bit because the mushroom part of Nick's book is really fascinating, and so I think it relates to a lot to the visit we're going to have with Kevin. I loved that part of Nick's book. And I think we're ready now with Kevin Olson. Kevin is a forager and founder of Northwoods Tea and Herb. It's based in Wausau, and we're going to talk with him about foraging for some food for yourself. And you'll be able to join in, by the way. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us the email address ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Kevin Olson, welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you now. We've got you. Thanks for joining in.
Good.
How'd you get into foraging?
I've been doing it pretty much my whole life. I lived across the street from the school forest when I was a kid, and I spent a lot of time in there. And then got into picking morales probably a little later, probably 15, 16. I had an uncle that gave me a field guide book, and then it just kind of went from there. And then we picked different mushrooms and then started picking different plants and then started drying them out, making teas out of them, my brother and I. And then I started my business and kind of went from there.
Yeah.
So it's
a long story because you've been doing it seemingly most of your life. Well, tell us, you founded Northwoods Tea and Herb. Tell us more about your business.
What I do is I sell wild harvested herbal tea, wholesale, different herbs and mushrooms. I have a nursery where we sell cuttings for wild stimulated cultivation for ginseng, elderberry, stuff like that. And we do like sub packing for other companies too. But for the most part, we sell wild harvested herbal tea, like chaga, elderberry, nettle, dandelion. We do like a mushroom coffee, even do a hickory tea from the shagbark hickory tree. So all stuff from the woods that, you know, are good to, you know, for culinary, for tea, and also good for you.
Yeah. Well, just talk about the benefits, a bit of these.
I mean, every herb has a different benefit, or mushroom. But I think a lot of it can be verbatim, there's a lot of information out there. about it. But what I like to tell people is that, you know, people talk about Chinese medicine, you know, for thousands of years. They talk about Native American medicine and the history of that, but it's not often talked about some of the medicinal value plants that they brought over from Europe, you know, probably 280 years ago. So a lot of plants that you see or that we're harvesting, you know, they're not native, maybe not invasive, but they were brought here. Elderberry is one. Well, there's a native elderberry, but there was the black elderberry. I think it's Sambucus nigra that was brought from Europe, and it was used for medicinal value. Dandelion, there's different species, but the main one that we see in the fields, that one was brought over. Nettle, they brought, there's a native nettle, but they brought over a stinging nettle too. So the history of the medicinal part of it goes way back, and some of it is almost lost. Mullein, which is good for, you know, your lungs, and they used it for all kinds of different stuff, you know, hundreds of years ago. And then we kind of just lost. I mean, the information's still out there, but a lot of people don't know about that part of it.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Jim from Oshkosh had called wondering about mushrooms here. The ones he calls puffballs are those circular white mushrooms that let out lots of spores if you squish them. There are some growing on his property in Oshkosh area. How many different kinds of these puffballs are there?
Well, I mean, puffballs, you know, really a common name. But there, for what we're thinking about, there's a lot of different kinds. But the ones, the big white ones are the ones that people are using and they're eating. I personally, I was hoping nobody would ask that because I don't like that one. I hate that one. I think it tastes terrible and they go bad really quickly. But there are people that they really do like those because they're easy to identify. So as far as how many different species, I'm not sure in what realm on that. I'd say there's really just one main one that everybody is usually talking about, and there's stuff that kind of looks like it, but they're either not white or they're something a little different, I guess.
Yeah, these the puffballs that I'm familiar with are, you know, as white as a sheet of paper.
Yeah,
and pretty hard to miss what they are, and they can get pretty good size, like a giant softball at least, I think, but. So when you eat them, you don't like the taste.
No, I don't. And I think they go bad pretty quick too. So sometimes they look really good and you can cut them open and they're just the worst smell. And once you smell that one time, you don't really usually eat those anymore. So that's what happened to me. So if I see them, I don't even bother with them. But some people do like them, and they don't really, if they're in their prime, they don't, to me, have a lot of flavor anyway. So they can be pretty good if you cook them up in something, because they, you know, they'll take a lot of the flavor from, you know, whatever dish they're in. So
yeah,
good for texture. So.
Yeah, that there you go. Kent in Reedstown emailed us. He says, we've soaked charga, and it's a black liquid for a long time. Wonders if it spoils.
The chaga? They made a chaga extract, and you asked, when does it spoil?
He says, does it spoil?
Like anything, yeah. A lot of people, I guess in the rough form, once it's dried, it's good for a really long time. But like anything, you know, it'll degrade over time and get stale. But I wouldn't consider dry chaga to spoil. If you make an extract or a tea out of it, which is what most people do, they'll put it in their fridge for a week or so. But like anything, you know, once you make it into a form like a liquid, you've got to refrigerate it for a certain amount of time, otherwise it'll go bad.
Yeah.
I've never heard of anybody getting sick off of any spoiled chaga in particular, I guess. So
there you go. Kevin Olson, our guest today, forager and founder of Northwoods Tea and Herb. It's based in Wausau, but he gets around a little bit. I'm going to ask him about him coming to Madison. He comes, I believe, at least once in a while to the events that are going on around here to sell things, sell some of his products. And, of course, you can take your questions. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. We'll take a quick look at the news, and I've got many more questions for him, and I bet you do as well. We'll be back for those questions and answers right after this look at the news. Stay with us. Talking about edible wild plants on the program now. Larry Mueller here on WPR with my guest. Lucky to have Kevin Olson with us. Kevin's a forager and founder of Northwoods Tea and Herb. It's based in Wausau. And as we talk with Kevin, I hope you'll join in. What questions do you have about plant identification? Maybe you have a favorite plant you forage for. Love to hear from you. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us, email address ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Paul in Darlington has a question for you, Kevin. Let's go there. Hi, Paul.
Hello, Larry. Hello, Kevin. My question is, I do a lot of foraging as well and morel hunting. I manage an 850-acre piece of land. What I've found recently is, an elm tree, you know, when it's in its prime, where it should start to develop morels. I'm not finding morels, but what I'm getting is golden oyster mushrooms are taking over that property.
Oh, golden oysters, you're saying?
Do you feel that thing, the morel mushroom growing effects?
Okay, Paul, you were breaking up a little bit, but I think I have your question. You're finding a lot of golden oysters out in your property, and you're not finding the morels at least yet, and wondering if these are kind of an invasive mushroom, Kevin.
Right. Well, yeah, that's a cool topic that you could talk a lot about. So I guess the history of it, and I guess don't quote me too much on it, but rumor has it that it was grown somewhere, I think in Illinois, and it escaped captivity, and it's basically kind of run rampant. So I've seen a lot of it in the southern part of the state, and I haven't seen really any of it in the central part of the state. It almost seems like it kind of follows the line of the emerald ash borer, which is unique to me. I don't know if that has to do with like the tension zones that grow through the state, or if it's, you know, if that beetle has anything to do with moving it around. But it doesn't seem to spread as fast as it would in theory, because it's spores and the wind. But there is a lot of it down there, and it's a really good one to eat. I like it because you can get a lot of it. And I sell mushrooms and plants for a living, so I actually really like that one because I can get a lot more golden oysters than I can with just regular your white ones. But I also pick a lot of morels myself, and I haven't seen any correlation with golden oysters and morels, and, you know, if they affect each other. I mean, morels are, you know, on the ground, a lot of them mycorrhizal, while, you know, your oysters are on a dead log. So, in fact, I kind of like it because if I see golden oysters, I usually find morels and vice versa. So I don't know if I call it invasive yet. I consider it more introduced. I haven't seen, and I don't want to ruffle any feathers because I'm sure people would disagree. But I mean, I don't see an issue. I see all our regular oysters with the golden oysters. It's just another mushroom in the woods. And it's here, so might as well use it. But I think maybe where the question comes from more is that people are finding less morels, and, you know, they're maybe looking for an answer why. And years ago, we found, when I was a kid, we had Dutch elm disease go through, and there was, the morels were just, which, you know, kills the elm trees, and morels and elms are kind of go hand in hand. And there were tons of morels for years, and then it kind of petered off, as we don't really have a lot of elms. And even my good spots that I go and harvest morels, I mean, I'm finding a lot of them under cottonwoods and dead and dying ash, but I don't find a lot of those really good prime dying elms. So I don't think there's any correlation between the two, but all I can say is that if you've got the golden oysters, you know, they're just as good, if not better, than morels, in my opinion. So
there you go, Paul. Well, Chris in Adams has a comment about morels. So let's
good morning.
Good morning, Chris.
Actually, it's afternoon.
It is.
I picked a bunch of morels one year, and I took them home, and I did what you're supposed to do, which is cut them in half and make sure that they're clean on the inside. And I found a great big slug in one of them. So unless you're going after escargot before you cook them, you should cut them in half and wash them out.
good idea, isn't it, Kevin?
Well, I guess I have a slightly different take on it.
Okay.
So when I personally cook morels, I don't clean them that much. I mean, I try to keep sand off of them while I pick them. And sometimes you get a little in there. I'll soak them. But a lot of times I dry them. So I don't eat a lot of fresh morels. I pretty much dry them all. And how I do that is I'll either get a screen if I'm at home, but if I'm out in the woods or, you know, I'm camping or I'm in a hotel and I'm out picking morels, I'll get all my morels and I'll get like fishing line, like 30-pound test, you know, for like muskie. And I'll get a big needle, like a biggest needle you can get, and I'll run that line through all of the morels, and I'll hang them up, kind of, if you can picture that. So they're almost like a clothesline, but there's a needle going through the stem of the mushroom, and I'll hang them up and I'll dry them. And I do that because two reasons. One, they last, so I can put them in soups, and I think once they're dried, they taste a little better to me when you reconstitute them and cook them anyway. But the other thing is, the bugs, you know, they like that mushroom because it's a moist area, it's wet, it's what the right conditions. And when that starts to dry out, they don't like that. And a lot of those bugs they'll bore themselves out, or they'll leave on a lot of mushrooms. So if you get them when they're buggy, as we call it, dry them out. And you know, you might have to watch a little bit. I mean, a slug might not come out, but normally they'll leave, and then you can, you know, just go from there. So you can still use those morels that are getting on the backside and they're a little buggy. And plus, you know what, bugs, I don't think they're going to hurt you. And I've had people come up to, because I do farmers markets and stuff over the years, and they come up and they say, well, how do you know a bird didn't poop on it or there's not a bug in it? And it took me like 2 years of thinking about that. Like, how am I supposed to answer that? Because I really don't know. So now I just say, well, you know what? There might be. We don't charge extra for protein, you know. So they're not going to hurt you if they're in there anyway. But you can still use them. So that's my take on that.
All right. Thanks for very much for that question. By the way, here's a personal note. I was rummaging around in my cupboard, and I found, and this has got to be, some dried morel mushrooms that are kind of hermetically sealed in a bag that I forgot about. And that's got to be 3 years old. And I'm wondering if I could reconstitute them okay.
Well, I guess it really depends. I'm not sure if the health department's listening or not. I mean, I don't know the rules, but if it were me, I would use them. I think they're fine. I mean, when you get things in dried form like that, I dry a lot of stuff out, and a lot of wild ramps and mushrooms and all the plants that we can eat. And what I found over the years is that the longer that they sit, because I've got stuff that's been dried out 5, 6, 8, 10 years ago. You know, I don't sell it, but you find it sometimes in your cupboard or whatever, like you're saying. But the only difference that I found is that it might lose some of its flavor just because it's just getting kind of stale. Yeah. But that's not gonna hurt anybody. I'd eat them. And if you don't, I'm sure there's other people that probably will take them from you. So
I'll probably wind up putting them in a soup.
Yeah, that's what I would do.
Yeah, that's what's going to happen to those morels, because I hate to waste them. I was kicking myself when I found them because I just had forgotten I had them. A listener emailed us, can you discuss your favorite foraged plants for tea? And by the way, says, hey, great discussion. So thank you for that.
Boy, that's a hard one. I have a lot of favorites. I mean, elderberry, I spend a lot of time with that one. I love that one. It makes a good tea. I like sumac, your staghorn sumac, which you see on the side of the highways. That's a really cool one. I mean, they use that as a spice. I believe some guy came up to me at a farmer's market, and a really old guy is like, that's the original pink lemonade. And I was like, yeah, I don't know about that. And I looked it up, and there definitely is some sources out there that say that it is. So, and then it also makes a really good hot tea. So I like, you know, the plants and different, I guess, any flora that has multiple uses like that. So I think sumac is one of my more favorite ones. But I mean, that could talk for days about, but for drying out and using for teas, I think, yeah,
those are your favorites.
Yeah.
Okay. Cody emailed us, well, this is back to morels for a minute. He says, many times you will not find morels under dead elms with oysters on the tree, as the morel flush is usually only the first 3 years, and the oysters don't get growing on the dead elms until they are 2 to 3 years old.
Yeah, that's true. But there's a lot of other trees around those trees. So, I mean, you get into a woods where there, you know, there's a mix of dead and living and everything in between. And just, I guess, anecdotally, I mean, I've found a lot of them together, not on the same within 6 inches, but if I see golden oysters, it just seems like the right kind of forest, the right kind of area to go and check. And I've usually been fairly successful, but I mean, there's a lot of arbitrary stuff about that. I mean, and how everybody hunts for them is totally different. So,
yeah. Well, one favorite spot, which I'm not going to tell you exactly where it is, but there is, every year that I have gone into this woods and by actually some oak trees, I find in this one spot, for some reason, there's always morels, and they're around oak trees.
Right, and I found them under all kinds of different trees, and I spent a couple of years trying to figure out why, and I don't know, but I do know that there's a lot of newer research that they've been doing, especially even in Wisconsin. There's a few people that really get into mycology, and they're finding, you know, that there are a lot of different species of morels, and to us they look the same, but some of them are, they look the same, but they're like a little subspecies to a degree that grows in a different area. So like, I guess to try to explain that, down south in south western part of the state, I look for different habitats and different trees for morels than I do in, say, Eagle River. Where a lot of times in Eagle River, we're looking under popple, a lot of popple trees, and that's where we tend to find them. And I guess it's because they're slightly different species. I mean, I don't know enough about that to really go into great detail, but you do find them under all kinds of different places, and it depends where you're at.
Yeah, orchards too. People find them in orchards all the time.
Right.
That reminds me. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I said, but you can't beat like southwestern part of the state. I mean, we can go down there, we can find a bushel of them, and they're bigger than your hand. Where, you know, up north, we can find a couple here and there, but it's tough. That just isn't right for them. So,
Yep. So it's an issue. Anne in the city emailed us just back to the white puffballs, and she mentions that some get as big as a soccer ball, and she's right. But she says Anne's mother would pick the smaller ones when they were still snow white. She'd slice them about an inch thick, dip them in egg and breadcrumb, and then fry them in butter, and they were delicious. Of course, you can fry pretty much anything in butter, and it's going to be delicious.
Yeah, that's kind of the thing. I mean, I probably would eat them then, but yeah, I mean, if you have to do that.
Megan emailed us. She's wondering how to introduce foraging to children safely. She's actually written a few books on this subject for kids and parents, and I hope she's giving safe information. But how do you introduce foraging to children safely?
For kids, I think as far as the safety part, I mean, you should know, you know, more than them probably, and you should probably watch them. But there's a lot of the plants and mushrooms, and I say this with caution, most of them are pretty safe. Even the ones they say are poisonous are usually, you know, you really got to eat them. And even sometimes, a lot of times, it's not going to hurt you that bad. So I guess what I should rephrase that as, it's not as dangerous going out there as people think. I mean, you should know the ones that are poisonous and be educated before you take, you know, any kids or anybody out. But I think it's important to get them out there because, like, I'll go back just shortly. So I grew up across from the school forest, and, like, I think a year ago they clear cut it. So they cut it all down. So I, you know, I went over to their parents' house for Christmas, and I said, well, they cut the, why would they do that? And it was like, well, I guess they're not teaching the kids about ecology anymore. So my reason I'm saying that is because I like getting people into foraging, especially kids and anybody, because the more people get into it, the more they're going to care about it, you know? And that's the most important thing. If we're using those things and kids are getting interested in it, you know, maybe they'll help protect it, you know? So, but as far as the safety part, I think just have to get educated and know what you're looking at. And
I'm sorry to hear about the school forest. I mean, have you seen an interest in foraging change over time? Is it more? Are there more? What do you think?
There's a lot more. And I would attribute that to just there's more information out there. There's a lot of there's apps that people are using. I don't always think they're very accurate. But they can be more confident at what they're looking at. Because it's like learning your flora and fungi is like a different language. And, you know, if you can be confident with an app or you can take a picture of it and upload it to like iNaturalist and you know that, oh, that's a ramp. It's not a, you know, a iris or something like that. So you know that you're confident, then that's what's – so there's more of an interest, and people like to be connected to nature, and there's more people getting into it, but especially because it's easier to go out and identify those. And there's more groups out there guiding people out there. So I think those couple things are making it more popular.
What do you think are there, you know, you want to be let me call it ethical forager.
Mm-hmm.
You want to? What are the responsibilities of an ethical forager?
Well, that's where it gets complicated. First, just the thought of that is good. You know, people should know what they're doing and constantly, you know, go back to it and look at what they're doing. Example, back, you know, 100 years ago or so, they cut down all the virgin forests and they teach that in school, that they did that and it was bad, but they don't always, you know, get to the point of how did it happen? Are they just that careless? But I don't think so. I think that they thought that it would take a lot of people, a lot of, you know, a couple lifetimes to cut all the virgin forest down. So it wasn't a concern, but it still happened. So you look at that and think that, you know, sometimes if you are just taking one leaf of a plant or you're just taking a couple, you have to think about how that affects the ecology and everything else. So It's very important, and I'm a big advocate for sustainable harvesting. And I do I'm 7 years into a wild ramp research project where I have grids out there. We harvest them different ways and see how they come back, how fast they come back, and find out how can we commercially harvest this without, you know, getting, you know, losing them, or how can we do it sustainably. So there's a lot, and I think if anybody doesn't know that, or doesn't know how, or how they're affecting the ecosystem when they're out harvesting or foraging, they should, and they should get in touch with people that are doing it, or get into a club or a group and be aware of what they're doing and their actions.
Yeah.
So very important.
Jill's wondering, do you ever freeze mushroom, or can you freeze mushrooms and get anything sort of out of that?
Yeah. So, for example, like, we call it shrimp of the woods. I think it's like a bordered entebola, or I'm probably not pronouncing it right, but it's a fall mushroom, and it's really good. It only comes off for like a week or two, and I've tried a lot of different ways. So what we do, and with that one, and probably all the other ones, is you cook it, fried up in butter, like the one lady said. You could do that, I guess, and then freeze it. So just freezing them in the hole like that, they just don't, they're not good when you thaw them out. But if you cook them and then freeze them after they're cooked, I found they're fine. That's what I would do.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. Usually most of those things, if you cook them first, that works with sweet corn and a whole bunch of other things as well. So very good point. Are you going to be at the Madison Farmers Market this year?
Yeah. Yep. Go down there. I think it starts this Saturday, actually.
Yeah.
That's the first one. And there's a lot of people there. And if you get there early, you're going to get a lot more stuff because they run out. But I do that one almost every Saturday. And it'll be a couple weeks, and I'll have ramps down there and mushrooms if we get them. And I'll be selling all my herbal tea and mushroom coffee and all that stuff. So.
Oh, mushroom coffee. That sounds good, Kevin. Thanks so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it. And we'll look forward to seeing you at least I will, at the farmer's market. Thank you very much, Kevin.
Yep, thanks.
Kevin Olson, forager and founder of Northwoods Tea and Herb. They're based in Wausau, but he gets around to the farmers markets and other places as well. But the name of the business, Northwoods Tea and Herb in Wausau. Well, tomorrow on the show, Chad Spate's back to talk about home improvement, some tips on starting and finishing a home remodel project. That and more, that's at 11 tomorrow. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots in store on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller.